Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How many helpless children lack permanent homes and parents in today's world, and what role should American families play in giving them a chance for a better life? Adoption has long been a go-to option for potential parents who can't conceive and bear their own biological children. But in many evangelical Christian congregations across the country, families are being urged to adopt from overseas as a compassionate way to discourage abortion and to relieve the suffering from what's been called the global orphan crisis. These families overwhelmingly have benevolent intentions. But as my guest today has learned, they may unintentionally be driving a lucrative market for foreign adoption in which demand exceeds supply and children are removed from vulnerable but caring families. The new book by journalist Catherine Joyce is called The Child Catchers, Rescue Trafficking and the New Gospel of Adoption. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
How did this subject come to your attention as something you really wanted to go in depth on?
Right. Well, I'm coming as a background as somebody who's written a lot about religion. And as I was working on my last book, about communities that believe that they should accept as many children as God gives them, I was talking to a lot of people who already had large biological families who were then starting to get involved in adoption. And this was surprising to me. I think, like a lot of other people, I assumed that adoption was more something that families contending with infertility would do. So seeing these large families who were adopting because they felt driven by their religious faith, because they felt God was calling to them to adopt, really inspired me to learn more about what that call was, why people were responding to it as they were.
So I want to talk about this issue of the global orphan crisis, which on the face of it is obviously deeply disturbing. Some estimates put the number of orphan children in the world today as high as 200 million. Who gets counted as an orphan in those statistics?
Right. I mean, those are just staggering numbers, and there are a lot of different estimates for them. That is the highest one. But what those estimates actually refer to is UNICEF tallies for orphaned and vulnerable children. So the second part of that phrase is really important because, by and large, that number represents children who have lost one parent only. So there's a fraction of that number that are children who have lost both parents, but even those children might be living with extended families. So it's really not quite the same definition of orphan that we use generally here in the U.S. It's a child who just has nobody in the world, but this refers to a whole range of children who are in vulnerable circumstances.
But if other children are, all those children are being counted, it would make sense that people hear these numbers and they think, well, if it's even remotely possible, I ought to do something about this.
Absolutely. I mean, it's you hear numbers like that, and the problem seems just astronomical. And people very understandably want to get in line and want to help. But there's another way in which kind of using those numbers as some sort of indication for the children who are available for adoption is not helpful, because overwhelmingly, U.S. adoption demand is for children who are young, for babies a lot of times, or for children under two. Overwhelmingly in the world, the number of children who are actually available for adoption are children over 5 years old. Hmm. So there are a few different ways in which that number, the idea of the orphan crisis, is driving a lot of Western demand for adoption that is actually not quite matching the children who are actually in need of families.
Is the demand for babies about, and please excuse the crudeness of the term, is it about the fact that parents, prospective parents, worry that older children will somehow be damaged goods, will have experienced trauma, and therefore not integrate well into their own families?
Well, I mean, I think that's one reason, certainly. I mean, there are a lot of concerns that people have about adopting older children or children from the foster care system here in the U.S., and sometimes I think there are other personal reasons that people are more interested in adopting babies or small children. Sometimes they don't want to disrupt the birth order if they already have children at home. They don't want to adopt a child who's older than their existing children because of, you know, issues that might cause. Sometimes people want the experience of parenting babies. You know, it's hard to judge, you know, the desire to parent a baby across the board, but it's just important to look at that and understand that the amount of Western demand, you know, again, we have to use those terms, can sometimes be a distorting influence on some of the countries where children are being adopted from.
All right, you mentioned Western demand, and that's really what we're talking about today, or American demand. In the case of the, and I'm using air quotes here, the true orphans who have neither parents nor extended family who can care for them, is there no market for domestic adoption within their own home cultures and countries?
Well, that's really interesting because that is something that a lot of countries and a lot of development groups, either faith-based or secular or, you know, kind of large-scale international adoption, but development organizations are starting to look at is the question of domestic alternatives to international adoption. So you see in some of the biggest countries where children are coming from for adoption now in Africa, particularly like Ethiopia or starting to be in Uganda, there are various projects in place. A lot of governments are involved in what they call deinstitutionalization. Mm-hmm. So that's trying to move children out of orphanages into family situations. A lot of times those children can go back to their own families or to extended families. But barring that, they are looking kind of as a second or third level option at promoting domestic adoption. So that is starting to happen to varying degrees of success in some of these countries, and it's something that I think a lot of people are interested in promoting more.
What has fueled so many evangelical Christian congregations to take up this cause and really look at the global orphan issue as something that they can address?
Sure. Well, around 2007 was kind of a key turning point year. There were some groups that had been active for a few years before that. One of them was the Christian Alliance for Orphans that had been meeting with just a few dozen people for a few years. But in 2007, that organization met in Colorado Springs with focus on the family and some real heavy-hitting Christian leaders like Rick Warren of Saddleback Megachurch in California. And out of that meeting came a real conversation that Christians are called by God to get involved in helping the orphan and the widow. And there were a number of, you know, biblical citations that they brought in to make this point and to show how this was part of the Christian tradition. But you saw from that people going forth, leaders going forth and talking to their congregations and saying, you know, this is something that is really part of the biblical mandate. And I think that there were a few motivations for that. I think, the largest one was a desire to do something to help. I think a lot of conservative evangelicals feel that they have become unfairly associated with just the things that they oppose by opposing abortion or gay marriage or things like that, and they wanted to be, you know, known for enthusiastically being for something, doing something to help. I think a lot of them also felt that they had kind of ceded the turf of doing social justice work to the more liberal denominations that are out there, and they wanted to reintegrate that into their own practice. And also, people spoke about this as a way they could be more holistically pro-life. Some of them spoke of it as being whole life, with W-H-O-L-E. So there are, you know, these different ways in which this kind of matched up with their existing ideas about how to help children and existing positions on abortion. And there was also, to a much lesser extent, there was a focus in some of the theology that grew up around this called adoption theology or orphan theology, that this was a way that they could be kind of saving children twice, giving them a home, taking them out of a bad situation, but also introducing them to the gospel. So there was a bit of a theological or missionary message in some of the books that people were writing about this. So you saw pastors going to their churches and modeling adoption, sometimes by adopting themselves, and then there would start to grow in these congregations what insiders were calling a contagious or a viral adoption culture of just dozens or even hundreds of families adopting all within a couple of years.
A few years ago, we did a show on international adoption, and we were speaking with, I believe it was a family counselor who said the most successful adoptions are those in which parents don't think of themselves as saving a child. And in this case, we were talking in the secular sense and not the religious sense.
Sure.
But they simply think of they sort of grieve for the fact that it's not their biological child, and then they celebrate the fact that this is part of their family. Did you find that the families you talked to do sort of feel heroic for having having rescued these children from what they believe to have been very dire circumstances?
Well, I mean, there's obviously just a huge wide spectrum of, you know, within evangelical Christianity and within adoptive parents and yeah. within this movement. So, you know, many folks in this movement, many adoptive parents have thought long and hard about those questions and, you know, certainly kind of do not see themselves as saviors. But one thing that I did find in a lot of my reporting is that there, in some corners of this movement, there is a bit of a troubling tendency to elevate adoptive parents as saviors, as heroic. And I think that that sort of narrative, kind of the idea of adoption as purely rescue, as a narrative, is something that has been a little bit dangerous in this movement because adoption is also extremely complicated, and international adoption in particular is just an incredibly complicated ethical issue. And positioning it as only good, as only beautiful, and only a means of rescue, and kind of ignoring some of those other more troubling sides of it, has, I think, had some people, it's had the effect of some people not being alert to the problems that there are and the challenges they need to look out for.
Certainly, we know that different countries have become hotspots for international adoptions over the years, and they sort of mushroom up and then sometimes contract again. How do particular places, Catherine, become ripe markets for adoptable children?
Well, exactly as you said, adoption overseas kind of tends to function as this bouncing ball. It goes from country to country, hotspot to hotspot, with a boom rising very quickly. And with that incredible demand that there comes from children from, say, Guatemala or Ethiopia, then you start to see a rise in incidence of ethical problems. Families who report that they were misled about what adoption means, stories of money changing hands where it shouldn't have, people being offered payments either to relinquish children in a few cases, but more commonly to kind of intermediaries, middlemen who will identify children who could go overseas for adoption, or kind of coercing or recruiting children from intact families. So we saw that particularly in Ethiopia in the last few years. And those sorts of stories, kind of as they add up, will lead to a country usually having to tighten its regulations and either slow or suspend its adoption program. So I think a few things can lead into that situation happening. A lot of times, the countries where children are coming from are de facto countries that do not have the same capacity for oversight that we would like to see, you know, here in the U.S. So these countries, which are often struggling, sometimes they are struggling after severe poverty or natural disasters or in the wake of sustained conflict, they just don't always have the infrastructure to be making sure that the correct children are the ones going for adoption. And that's really when we start to see some of the problems.
My guest this hour is journalist Catherine Joyce. Her new book is called The Child Catchers, Rescue, Trafficking, and the New Gospel of Adoption. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes and invite you to join us. You can do that by calling into our open lines at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send an email to think@kera.org. We'll be back with Catherine Joyce in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Catherine Joyce, author of the new book, The Child Catchers, Rescue Trafficking and the New Gospel of Adoption. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Catherine, I want to go back to something you said a little bit before the break, which was that there have been cases in which families of origin have been misled about what adoption means. And I think to American ears, that might sound strange, but what you discovered was that the way we define adoption in this country turns out not to be a universal term.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's true. And I think in some countries, this might be one of the most significant problems that we're facing, perhaps in Ethiopia and Uganda currently. Those are two countries where that's a particular problem. When I was in Ethiopia, in southern Ethiopia, which is a region where a lot of adoptable children are coming from, I spoke with the family of three girls who were adopted to the U.S. In the middle of the last decade. And this was, by Ethiopian standards, this was a pretty middle-class family. The mother had died years before in childbirth, but the father was healthy and employed as a government clerk, and the older siblings were variously in college or, you know, had professional jobs as nurses and teachers. But in church one day, they had heard from representatives of a local orphanage, which was affiliated with a U.S. adoption agency, that there was a great chance for children to go abroad to the U.S. for adoption. This was kind of presented to them as more or less an educational opportunity, a chance for their girls, the three youngest girls, to go abroad, get a great education, advance their opportunities in life, and then come back and help the family. On the other side of the ocean, here in the U.S., the adoptive family was viewing video footage of these girls, and they were being told that they were HIV/AIDS orphans, that the mother who had died in childbirth had actually died of HIV/AIDS, and that the father was sick, and if the girls weren't adopted, they were facing very bad circumstances. Perhaps they would have to be turned into prostitutes in order to provide for themselves and the families. None of this was true, but the U.S. adoptive family, led by, you know, remarkably good intentions to help, ended up signing up to adopt these children. And, you know, when they came and the girls had, you know, photo albums full of pictures of this extended family that was seeing them off and, you know, wishing them well until the next time that they returned to Ethiopia, it became clear that, you know, first of all and most seriously, that serious inaccuracies and fraud had taken place in this adoption. But moreover, that there was also a really root disconnect in how the Ethiopian families were being introduced to the idea of adoption. There, in Ethiopia and in some other African countries, there is a tradition like adoption, but it's not the same idea of a permanent transfer of parental rights that we have here in the U.S. It's more that I might send my children to my wealthier brother or sister when, you know, I'm having a particularly troubled season of not making enough money for the family, or because my siblings could offer a better education for my children. But it's never this idea that I am giving up my children to another family for good. So I think adoption sometimes, if agencies aren't being extremely clear with the Ethiopian families or the families in some of these sending countries about what it is that they're agreeing to, it can be playing on a different tradition in a very destructive way.
And in the case of the American couple of prospective parents who got this information that clearly was incorrect, it turns out a lot of adoption agencies will have prospective parents fill out a form that doesn't hold them accountable if there are inaccuracies in the sort of backstory or details. And I guess, I mean, if I as a parent signed that document, I would assume it meant, well, if the birthday's off by 3 months or something, I'm not going to, you know, sue the agency. But in the hands of people who are not being honest, it gives them carte blanche.
Absolutely. I mean, I want to be clear that, you know, there are agencies that do some really quite inappropriate things, and then there are also agencies that are behaving much more responsibly.
Of course.
So this does not apply, of course, across the board. But there are agencies that have prospective adoptive parents, their clients, sign off that they're not accountable for the information that they're providing. And to think of that. That's actually, you know, a pretty troubling situation to put these families in. But I think, just as you said, many of them would not imagine the extent to which the information that they receive could be untrue. But in speaking with a lot of the adoptive parents or people who began adoptions and then found out something and decided to stop the process, some of the things that they found out were untrue are really startling and upsetting. You know, parents who were said to be dead, who are in fact alive, or, you know, family members who, you know, were said not to exist, you know, said that this was an only child, in fact has, you know, a number of brothers and sisters or active aunts, uncles, and grandparents who are involved in their lives. So some of these deceptions, we have to say, are really have a very strong implication for whether or not these children should have been adopted. And some of these adoptive parents can also be badly hurt.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Cynthia in Dallas. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling because I adopted from the CPS CPS, and my best friend adopted from Ethiopia because they wanted a baby, and I wanted a teenager. And in both cases, we discovered that there definitely was family. In fact, my friend in Ethiopia was just stunned to actually meet the mother before we left. Mm. And then we discovered the day before we left that he actually had a brother there, too, that nobody had known about. And so my friend, who has kept in touch with the family that adopted the brother, you know, is trying to keep them in touch. And with my son, he has a sister who was also adopted. And so, you know, we have to keep, you know, we try to keep their relationship going. But what I learned is that there is always family. There was family that didn't want to adopt my son, and so he was in the system, like his grandparents. And so I guess that's the one thing that really surprised me, was that when you're in adoption, you're adopting a whole other family, not just a person.
Hmm. What do you think about that? Thanks so much for your call, Cynthia. What do you think about all that, Catherine?
Thank you, Cynthia. I think that that's a really powerful point. And I think it's also an interesting point that, yes, sometimes there is existing family who are not equipped or, you know, aren't willing to step in. And, you know, so those children are, in fact, you know, in need of adoption and a new family. But I think, you know, this is a really interesting thing that is becoming more characteristic of adoptions, certainly here in the U.S. domestically, but also overseas a bit, that adoptions are, in general, becoming much more open. I think the statistic for domestic adoptions is that close to 95% are in some way open, which is, that can be a wide range of terms. That can mean ongoing relationships with the family, which it seems like Cynthia has in her adoption, in her family, but it can also mean just that at the beginning of the process, especially if it's a domestic infant adoption, the mother is aware of who the adoptive parents are, and there is some initial exchange of information. So it's a wide range of, in terms of what openness is and what that ongoing contact might look like. But that is certainly something that we're seeing with a lot of the domestic adoptions. And increasingly, I think that there is, you know, more ways for adoptive families to be in touch with the families of their children, their adopted children overseas. And so sometimes that's happening as well. It's really interesting.
Did you find that your sources throughout the story expected there to be fewer family complications because they were adopting from overseas as opposed to domestically, where theoretically it would be easier for a birth parent to come back and try to sort of claim that child?
Well, I mean, I certainly spoke to some people and, you know, read a lot of people kind of writing and blogging about their desire to adopt overseas because they were concerned about that. They were concerned about stories that they would start to adopt or have adopted a child for a period of time, and then they might encounter, you know, either kind of demands for families to come back into their lives or, you know, maybe to overturn the adoption. So I think that does inspire some people to look overseas. I think other people were looking overseas perhaps because there was a greater opportunity to adopt an infant there, or because they thought in a lot of cases that they were responding to this great need, something like the orphan crisis. So, you know, many different reasons that, people are moved to look overseas or domestically. But I think also people are finding overseas that, you know, a lot of times when they're adopting children that they think are orphans or that they have been told by their agencies are orphans, you know, sometimes this ends up not being the case. Children come home and learn English and are able to share that, you know, I have another mother, I have a father, or I have grandparents.
That must, it has to absolutely be devastating for parents to learn this. You know, they're sort of getting to know their child and they're getting over the adjustment process. And then finally they have a child they can communicate with in English. And then to hear these stories, I mean, I can't even imagine what that would feel like.
Oh, I know. I spoke with one mother in Tennessee, Jessie Hawkins, who shared her story of just that, of adopting a child who was said to be abandoned in Ethiopia, and the little girl came home, and at first she was acting out. You know, she was breaking dishes, she was, you know, cutting her doll's hair off, and things like this that, you know, perhaps she thought were just a sign of the troubles adjusting to life in the U.S. But then as the girl gained more facility in English, she was able to tell her, you know, no, I do have a mother. And you know, she was able to describe this in ways that made it clear. And then when the adoptive parent went and confronted the agency, they admitted that, yes, you know, what they had told her first was untrue and this child did have a mother. Mm. And that mother said she just didn't know what to do. You know, she said, you feel nauseous. You never think that you, by trying to do this wonderful thing, you're ending up having someone else's child just by virtue of the fact that you are, you know, wealthier and more privileged and from a nation that has a lot more power.
Who makes money when a child is adopted from overseas?
Well, that's an interesting question. Most adoption agencies, not all, but most are nonprofit, mm-hmm. but that doesn't end up meaning that there isn't a lot of money that changes hands. A lot of adoptions are extremely expensive. Adoptions from foster care in the U.S. are a notable exception, but most adoptions, both domestically and overseas, are in the range of $25,000 to $40,000. So it's not as though that money all goes to any one place. It doesn't even all go to the agency. But it will be paid in fees, and sometimes in significant fees to the agencies, but also there are portions of that money that are distributed and kind of trickle down into the countries, most often developing countries where these children are coming from. There might be a required donation of several thousand dollars to an orphanage. There might be staff who are paid on a per-child basis or a per-adoption basis in some of these countries. Notably in Ethiopia, when the program was just starting there, when it was really just starting to become a boom adoption country, some agencies were paying people, middlemen who functioned essentially as child finders, as much as $5,000 in a country where the average annual income is $500 to go and locate a child for adoption. So if you see somebody has the prospect of making 10 times what the average annual income is in a country, just if they will go and find a young child who matches the desired age and sex characteristics of Western adoptive parents, there's a lot of room for corruption.
So child finders, in some cases, are literally recruiting young pregnant women or recruiting families who appear to be struggling financially. How does that work?
Well, I think that there have been some cases of recruiting young pregnant women, and I think that happened more notably in Guatemala. That was a function of some of the adoption corruption there. In Ethiopia, it was more frequently people going to remote rural villages and talking to families about, you know, this adoption option. In some cases, it seems that it was represented to families as an education opportunity, as the story I spoke about before. In some cases, families in Ethiopia have gotten the impression that this is a way for them to have a U.S. sponsor, that it's something like the two families are becoming related rather than just the child is becoming adopted by another family. And so they think that, you know, there will be some sort of help or assistance, financial assistance or other material assistance coming from the adoptive family down the line. So there's just a kind of a few very basic misunderstandings that happen in a lot of cases. So in one famous case of child recruitment, a U.S. agency had one of their staff members videotaped as she was out in a community in southern Ethiopia, and she was in a great group of people. The whole town was assembled, and she was announcing, you know, if you would like your child to go to the U.S., please, you know, remain here and we will interview you. If not, you know, please take your child away. So it can be presented in such a way, kind of on this large scale, that it looks more like an opportunity than actually permanently relinquishing your child.
What does international law say about these practices and about the movement of children across international borders for the purposes of adoption?
Well, notably, here in the U.S., there is no designation of a crime for trafficking for adoption. So, you know, while we think about moving children, you know, for labor trafficking or, you know, God forbid, for sex trafficking, that those obviously are crimes. There isn't kind of a set recognition of trafficking for the purpose of adoption as a crime in this country. There is the Hague Intercountry Adoption Convention, which is a standard that many countries have ratified and agreed to. The U.S. did some years ago. And that is meant to prevent some of these abuses from happening. But there are some significant loopholes here in the U.S. with how we implement that. You know, kind of one of the key problems is that agencies here in the U.S. are not held completely accountable for what their partners do on the ground in countries like Uganda or Ethiopia. So considering many of the abuses happen at a very local level, there's a real lack of accountability. But another significant problem is the fact that we continue to do most of our international adoptions from countries that have not agreed to these Hague principles. Ethiopia, for one, is not a Hague signatory, and so we are continuing to have, you know, many children coming from countries that have not agreed to the same standards.
My guest is journalist Catherine Joyce. Her new book is The Child Catchers, Rescue Trafficking and the New Gospel of Adoption. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering summer courses for adults in literature and languages, cultural history, and arts and design at the Dallas, Plano, and Taos, New Mexico campuses. Registration at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Catherine Joyce. Her new book is called The Child Catchers, Rescue Trafficking and the New Gospel of Adoption. Join us by sending email to think@kera.org. And we have an email here from a listener who writes, "My husband and I felt pressured to adopt after 95% of the church staff he worked at had adopted. We would like to eventually adopt from one of our home countries, but this experience put a bad taste in our mouths. Likewise, there's so much pressure to participate in acquaintances' adoption fundraisers, even if they overlap other families' fundraisers, much like Kickstarter. We've also known too many people who continually post on Facebook and social media about lacking money because of these adoptions, but putting a spin on it as a trial stemming from their generosity." Does that sound familiar, Catherine, to you?
Wow, that's really interesting. That sounds very familiar. Absolutely. I think the thing about adoption, kind of this adoption culture that has sprung up in a lot of these churches is, you know, that it is asking, you know, these congregants to follow and kind of live out their faith by adopting, and in so doing enter an extremely expensive undertaking that, you know, is kind of no small matter. $30,000 is no small matter for most people.
Plus the cost of raising a child to adulthood.
Yeah, that's just the adoption cost, and then you have the child, and then you have to have all the expenses associated with that. But yeah, the fundraising for adoption has become extremely commonplace. Well, one of the things that we've seen as kind of the proliferation of this adoption culture in the evangelical community are hundreds of adoption ministries around the country. So there are some national scale adoption grant making organizations that will provide no interest loans or grants to Christians who feel that they're called to adopt, but also just hundreds at the church level, individual churches who have started ministries to help pay for the adoptions of their fellow congregants. So this was part of the call in the 2009 resolution of the Southern Baptist Convention. They put out a resolution on orphan care and adoption that was calling all of their members, and the SBC has 16 million members, to consider not if, but how they were being called to help orphans. And so they were saying, you know, many of you will be called to adopt, but for those of you who can't, you should consider contributing to some of your fellow church members' adoption costs. So this has become a huge thing. And it's interesting because adoption being promoted as one answer to the orphan crisis overlooks, I think, a little bit how the money works in this. So if, you know, all of these individuals are paying $30,000 to $40,000 for each adoption, kind of envisioning how that money might work more effectively at providing local solutions in some of these countries where that money would stretch a lot further is, I think, something that we need to pay attention to.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because in many developing countries, goodness, even $10,000 is a life-changing sum.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, you know, some of the most encouraging things that I've seen in some of these countries are initiatives, again, by faith-based groups, evangelical groups, as well as secular groups or government groups, to work instead of focusing on adoption and, you know, helping these children by sending them to new families in Europe or America, instead helping their families. So efforts towards what's called family preservation, or some groups, like there's a great group in Uganda called Reunite, that is working to take children who have kind of wrongfully been placed in the orphanage to adoption track and helping figure out what their family needs in order to take that child back and raise them. So sometimes it's a microloan of, you know, $100 or so to get a business started that will give them the security to keep their child home and not have an orphanage look like a better alternative than what they can provide themselves.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Melanie in Dallas. Hi, Melanie.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Not to take away from the sadness or even the tragedy of a lot of the stories you've shared, I don't think you've been specific about numbers since you first discussed the UNICEF hundreds of millions and described how that was really not an accurate number. And I was wondering if you could provide some numbers and percentages just to sort of give some scope to the size of the issue. How big is the infant population that people are trying to adopt versus how many people are actually trying to adopt, just to substantiate your supply and demand concerns, looking at the evangelical groups with good intentions but possibly for fueling that. How many of them are there? How many have been successful versus, again, the actual supply of infants that genuinely need homes?
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Thanks, Melanie. Well, I hate to disappoint, but I have to say that it's very hard to come up with those numbers. I spoke with a lot of people about trying to determine what numbers of those, you know, those hundreds of millions that are cited so frequently, what number of children is actually available for adoption. And the head of UNICEF's Child Protection Unit told me actually that number does not exist as far as they're aware of, and they don't think it's likely to exist. Any tally of children in the world who are actually available for adoption, we just don't have right now any way of figuring that out because of many things, because in many of these countries there is just inadequate record keeping to begin with, and also just that there has been no measurement of children who have nobody, who have lost both parents, who don't have an aunt or an uncle or grandparents who are going to step in, or who don't have other alternatives. So unfortunately, the frustrating reality is that there is not an exact number of children available for adoption in the world. Somewhat closer, there is an estimate for children who have lost both parents, and that is in the teens of millions. So I think it is around 15 to 17 million are considered double orphans. So that is children who have lost both their mother and their father. Among that number, there are still some who may be living with extended family, but it gets a little bit closer to an idea of children who might be in need of families. But that, again, does not, that's not broken down by age of, you know, which number of these are babies or young children. I can say that from speaking to child care representatives in a number of children, I'm sorry, in a number of countries, the reality is that most children available for adoption are not babies. I think 95% of the children available for adoption are over the age of five, whereas most adoption demand is for children younger than two. Hmm. So there is a mismatch there between, I mean, to use these coarse terms again, the demand and the supply. And then to get at Melanie's question about the numbers of the Christian adoption movement, once again, sorry to be a disappointment, but there is no tally in the U.S. of adoptive parents by religion, and we probably wouldn't want that. We wouldn't want the government to be tracking who adopts by religion, but it's just not something that the State Department does. You can get a little bit of sense of the agency side of it by looking at the number of agencies on the Hague-accredited list of agencies at the State Department, and about a quarter of those, so about 50 of 200, I identify as evangelical. So those are agencies that do overseas adoptions. Domestic is another question. But among that quarter, that 25% of agencies are some of the biggest adoption agencies that do the most number of adoptions both here and overseas. So they have their influence is greater than just the 25% of the market that they represent.
An email from Nancy in Dallas asks, how much of the evangelical call to adoption is based on a desire to convert non-Christians to Christianity?
Well, that's an interesting and kind of touchy question, of course. There, you know, I think most adoptive parents across the board are motivated by a desire to help and to increase their family or to start a family. And I think overwhelmingly that is what guides most people. But in doing a lot of reading of the adoption theology books that leaders in this movement have written, there is a focus on an evangelizing or missionary angle. Some of these leaders have said that adoption is a Great Commission activity, the Great Commission being the mandate to go and spread the gospel to the nations. Some have said that adopting is indistinguishable from missionary work because you are essentially doing missions under your own roof. You are creating a mission field within your own family by bringing new children into it. Another leader has said that as important as it is to find a home for a family, for a child in need, the ultimate purpose of Christian adoption is to introduce the child to the gospel. So you do have a number of prominent leaders who are making a theological case for adoption, that just as God adopted Christians, Christians need to go and replicate that by adopting other children and introducing them to the gospel. I mean, I want to be very clear, I don't think that this is the guiding reason for most individuals who adopt, but it is something that is there in the language of the movement.
Catherine, what did you learn about how natural disasters like the South Asian tsunami and the Haiti earthquake affect the orphan, again, I hate to use this word market, but market?
Yeah, well, I think that really does have an effect. I think a lot of the humanitarian response in the U.S. to the Haitian earthquake in 2010 centered around adoption and orphans. I think for a lot of people, it was understandably, it seemed like a way they could help, but there was just overwhelming adoption demand after that earthquake. Adoption agencies, including some of the largest in this country, said that, you know, their inquiries for adoption doubled in just a few months after the Haitian earthquake, that some said that they had 20,000 new inquiries for adoption after that earthquake took place. And of course, I think a lot of listeners will remember the story of Laura Silsby, the Baptist missionary from Idaho, who took a group of fellow missionaries down to Haiti and were trying to sort of do a bit of a vigilante adoption rescue mission by taking a group of 33 children across the border into the Dominican Republic. So you see in the wake of disasters a lot of groups springing into action and thinking that the best thing they can do is to get children out of the country and into safe American homes as quickly as possible. But as we saw with that Laura Silsby's case, almost all of the children that they tried to transport had living family, most of whom did not knowingly agree to send their children away forever for adoption. So we, you know, that's sort of a very bad, you know, kind of example in some ways, but in other ways, it's a bit of an exaggerated truth about how people can rush in with good intentions but not really understand the dynamic of what they're getting involved in and, you know, end up doing more harm than they do good.
So at this point, having done all this research, what would you recommend to prospective parents with good intentions? How can they know that everything's on the level when they begin the process of adopting from overseas?
Well, unfortunately, it's very difficult to know. I saw so many prospective adoptive parents approach this and come onto forums where a lot of adoptive parents and prospective parents gather to discuss the situation and ask what they can do, exactly what that question, what they can do to keep their hands clean, to make sure they're not adding to a corrupt industry. And unfortunately, it's just very hard to tell. They need to do very extensive research on any agency that they consider working with and look in every country where that agency has performed adoptions to make sure that there aren't patterns that are not acceptable. They need to look very closely at the country itself where they're considering adopting from and look to see whether or not it has seemingly become a new adoption boom country, if there is a troubling rise in the number of adoptions happening from that country in a short period of time, because that's often a sign of, you know, things happening in an incorrect way. And I think, you know, here in the U.S., maybe they should look to the foster care system and explore options like that and really be opened their mind and their eyes to the way in which our demand as wealthier Westerners, as Americans, can be a distorting influence. And so to try to look to where there is the greatest need and have that be part of their consideration.
Yeah, because if we don't get this right, it really is the children who are most deeply hurt.
Absolutely.
Catherine Joyce is a journalist and author of the new book, The Child Catchers, Rescue, Trafficking, and the New Gospel of Adoption. Catherine, it's been such an interesting hour. Thank you so much for joining us for it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. We had Joe Bellotti back on the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our podcast free every day at kera.org/think. We also always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. You can send those by email to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.